Well, welcome to this sixth in our current Darwin College lecture series on the theme of identity. And this afternoon we come in a very personal level to the heart of things, identity in the mind. What is it that makes us feel we have identity as individuals? And our speaker, we're very fortunate to have Raymond Tallis, who until recently was the Professor of Geriatric Medicine at Manchester University. Professor Tallis is a Liverpudlian, educated at Oxford and London, taught for a time in Liverpool, and has a large array of publications, scientific papers, and two textbooks on geriatric medicine and neurology. What makes him particularly interesting from our point of view is that he has another life, or other lives. He's written a novel, short stories, three books of poetry, books on art, literary criticism, and several books on the philosophy of mind. He thus brings to the subject an extraordinarily broad science and humanist background to tell us what it is that gives us identity of mind. Professor Tallis.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Brown, and good evening, everyone. I have to say, I feel greatly honoured to be being given one of this series of very prestigious series of lectures. Honoured and somewhat intimidated, partly by seeing the quality of the other lecturers, and also by the knowledge that there are some 500 or so Premier crew cerebral cortices facing me, even as I speak. I ought to begin, perhaps, by specifying what this lecture is about, because I don't think my title gives much away. I'm going to talk mainly about personal identity, the continuing sense of who or what one is, rather than identity in general. And this is not such a restriction as it may seem at first sight, and certainly insufficient grounds for invoking the Trades Descriptions Act. For it would be central to my argument that the notion of identity, except in a trivial logical sense, is properly located in first-person being. And even that the trivial logical sense is ultimately rooted in intuitions whose primary provenance is identity as it applies to persons. I won't have much to say about identity as it plays out in identity politics, for notwithstanding the passions that it invokes and the blood that has been spilled, this is a secondary or derivative aspect of identity. My interest in personal identity has little to do with the frankly tedious question of how English I feel, or with identity as something that is asserted, affirmed, protested, or sought when people feel marginalized, misrepresented, or threatened. No, my present concern is with identity at the most fundamental level. As if by way of compensation for narrowing the notion of identity, I'm going to look beyond the mind, the other abstract noun in my title, for the basis of personal identity. I will argue that although the mind, self-consciousness, memory, and so on, is central to personal identity, a standalone mind is insufficient to establish or sustain it. Nor indeed can the body, either as a material object or a living organism alone, deliver what is required. Both body and mind are necessary to underpin personal identity, both as it is subjectively experienced and as it is objectively acknowledged. In addition, the community of bodies and minds, which we call the human world, is necessary to elaborate and sustain it. And this may come as a surprise, I guess, only when we're philosophizing. Now, in what follows, you will observe your lecturer slithering between terms such as personal identity, the person, the self, the I, first-person being, and so on. The impression of sloppiness this may give is not entirely justified, for the terms capture different aspects of the beast in question, and trying to call them to conceptual order is a forlorn exercise. More importantly, I believe that these notions are all derived from a single ancestor, which I've called the existential intuition. And the existential intuition is the key concept in this talk, and it corresponds to the sense that I am this, where this, in the first instance, is my self-aware body, though it subsequently unfolds into a massively elaborated self, a correlative of an individual world. Now, those of you who are familiar with the philosophical literature may be disappointed, even outraged, that I will have little to say about the famous thought experiments which have dominated discussions of personal identity in recent decades and have been endlessly picked over by philosophers. I'm thinking, for example, of imaginary scenarios in which whole brains or cerebral hemispheres are transplanted from one body to another, and we're invited to consider whether a new body or new bodies containing the brain or the bits of the brain do or do not take on the identity of the original owner of the brain. I think such thought experiments are unhelpful and confusing, and will later explain why. Now, let me widen the discussion for a moment and consider identity per se. This is a relation, the relation something has to itself, and at first sight, nothing could seem simpler. While we may use the term identity, identical rather, in a loose sense, asserting that you and I have identical motives for doing something, or that twins are identical, in the strict sense, identity is, as the American philosopher Quine said, as tight as a term can be. A thing is strictly identical with itself. A is A. Not only simple, then, but boring. To quote Quine again, to say of anything that is identical with itself is trivial, and to say that it is identical with anything else is absurd. Don't be deceived. The notion of identity is neither simple nor trivial, not even identity in the strict logical sense. Firstly, while A is both simple and trivial, the prior conditions of this assertion and the context that make it worth asserting are not. The tautology A is A, the sort of thing that gives logic and philosophy by association a bad name, has extraordinarily deep foundations. These are largely off stage or off page. Logicians prefer it that way, liking their logic uncontaminated with the muddle and the malodor of the human. But we cannot ignore what is off stage. It's actually central to my theme today and to my claim that the primary mode of identity is personal identity, and other expressions of the identity relation are parasitic. That first person identity, I am this, is primary, and third person identity, A, is secondary. Now, to understand this, it helps to appreciate that while an entity is necessarily identical with itself, the identity relation exists only insofar as it is made explicit and/or asserted. And this requires at least two things. The first is the dissecting out of A as an entity. I may look at you, my audience, and see one audience or several hundred people. Several hundred people, or twice several hundred arms, plus other bits and pieces. An audience plus a lecture theatre, or a packed lecture theatre. The way that the world is divided is relative, amongst other things, to the way we perceive it and the language we use to describe it, which is in turn relative to our purposes. There are constraints, of course. I cannot see my audience as being composed of 25,000 human beings, or you may be relieved to know, of several hundred chimpanzees. The second requirement to make the identity relation explicit, and hence exist, is something like expressed doubt as to whether A really is A. Now, there are many circumstances under which such doubts may arise. First, I might encounter A at two different times and wonder whether I've encountered the same thing or two similar things. Secondly, I might bump into A in 1965, then again in 2007, and seeing that it has changed, wonder whether it is right to say it is the same thing. Has it changed sufficiently for me to say it is no longer the same thing, or it has become something else? Thirdly, I might hear of an item that it is the boat belonging to Joe, and wonder whether this is identical with the boat that I can see over there, or the boat that someone said is next to mine. Whether, in short, two experiences or two descriptions are accessing the same entity or accessing different entities. Now, once we bring the context necessary to make identity assertions happen, in from the cold and onto the page, we move from the banality and triviality of A is A to the meat of identity. Perceptions, the passage of time, language, all clothe naked tautology in matters of substance. The appearance of triviality is proving to have been deceptive. Most importantly, we can now see how the concept of identity cannot get a foothold in the absence of self-conscious beings. Yes, it will be agreed, chair A is chair A, but it does not have an intrinsic identity, unlike self-conscious beings. It doesn't carve itself out of a row of chairs or an auditorium. Nor does it have the intuition it is itself, the self-iteration, the italicization that marks the identity relation. This is unique to self-conscious beings. Now, what I said is not at all original. The 18th century philosopher Thomas Reid also argued that only persons can be considered as having identity, and that the identity of material bodies, or material events, is not intrinsic to them, but stipulated from without. One of the favorite examples for those who inquire into identity is that of a gentleman's club. If a club changes its members, its premises, its rules, and has only, as it were, an audit trail linking each phase with the next, is it the same club or not? If it has the same name, we might think so, but that is an arbitrary criterion. In fact, there is, to use Derek Parfit's phrase, no fact of the matter. And this is Thomas Reid's position. The identity, therefore, which we ascribe to bodies is not perfect identity. It is rather something which, for the convenience of speech, we call identity. It admits of great change of the subject, providing the change be gradual, sometimes even of total change. Identity has no fixed nature when applied to bodies, and questions about the identity of a body are very often questions about words. But identity, when applied to persons, has no ambiguity and admits not of degrees of more or less. In the cases of persons or selves, identity is not conferred from without. It is at least in part, and the most important part, the ground floor, as it were, stipulated or imposed from within. Identity is something that, first and foremost, is felt, hence its restriction to persons. Identity is I-entity, an assumption, as we shall see, that straddles flesh and logic. Even as applied to persons, identity is by no means a concept that is easy to grasp. Many of the difficulties of pinning down personal identity result from conflating different aspects of this rather complex notion. We need to tease out these different aspects so that we shall see it in the round and grasp what is fundamental, what underpins all the various aspects of identity that tend to be highlighted in different circumstances. First of all, there is my sense of who and what I am at any given time. And secondly, there's my sense of being the same who or the same what over time. These subjective dimensions, in turn, have many elements, and I will examine some of these presently. But for the moment, I would like to note that it is this second aspect of the subjective dimension of personal identity, that is, being the same who or the same what over time, that has attracted the lion's share of philosophical attention. And I will argue that this question about the endurance of personal identity over time, while important and indeed a main theme of this talk, is not the fundamental question. Fully to address it, fully to grasp the essence of personal identity, we need to understand the sense of self at any particular time. There are also what we might call external aspects of identity, those characteristics by which I am identified and classified by others, or by myself, taking an objective view of myself. It is these that supply objective criteria for my being counted, recognized, acknowledged as such and such a kind of person, and as the same person on different occasions. They are closer to what is utilized in identification. They underpin my claim to be identical with Raymond Tallis, a person others have met before, of whom certain things can be expected, who has rights, duties, possessions, and so on. Identity cards underline the link between identity and entitlements, the aspect of the problem that particularly exercises the Daily Mail. These external aspects also fall short of being fundamental. They would not have any meaning without the subjective aspect of identity. So the, in my view, erroneous primary focus on identity over time and the equally erroneous focus on external criteria for identity both distract from the core of the matter, the experience that I am. And this explains, what is more, the tendency amongst many contemporary philosophers to try to reduce personal identity to impersonal facts, to imagine that a third-person account will reveal the true nature of first-person being. Now, I've distinguished objective from subjective aspects of identity, but they are, of course, profoundly interrelated. My subjective who will be shaped, colored, in the most intimate and complete sense informed by the objective what. Much of my sense of who I am will be an internalization of the facts about me and the behaviors these require, the expectations they will raise regarding others' behavior towards me. My belief in the objective fact that I am my wife's husband will influence my expectation of how she will behave towards me. So when I enter our house, she acknowledges my identity, rooted in part in our shared life, by asking me if I've posted a particular letter, rather than by calling for the police to expel an intruder. So far, anyway. This illustrates how the world in which we live provides a scaffolding supporting an elaborate sense of self, which would otherwise be highly volatile. I emphasize this because while I'm mainly going to talk about the psyche, the mind, and the body in the creation and sustaining of personal identity, once we move beyond the bare sense that I am, or as that sense that I am grows in complexity, is socialized and narrated, the collective of minds and the culture they create and uphold is of huge importance in establishing what I am. So much then for the subjective and objective aspects of personal identity. But before we examine them further, it's appropriate to ask why personal identity is so important, and under what circumstances it may become a pressing problem or even cause anguish. Here are some. In adolescence, when we awaken to the possibility of an independent life, in which we to some degree define what we are or shall become, we search for an image and idea of ourselves that will flatter us or satisfy our desperate need for self-esteem. And then there are times when we have to make decisions that are of such fundamental importance that we have to know what we truly are, so we shall know what to stand for. At other times, we may look back over our lives and seeing that we, our values, our priorities, our entire way of life has changed, wonder whether we are the same person. In illness, head injury, dementia, others may question whether we cease to be the person we once were, or whether we are indeed any person any longer. Now, these occasions, when identity becomes an issue, to some extent justifies the emphasis in the philosophical literature on the endurance or continuity of the self over time, as opposed to the more fundamental question as to the nature of selfhood at a particular time, on what makes one the same person as opposed to what constitutes personhood itself. For pretty well everything that matters in identity is gathered up in the idea of the self as something definite, enduring, singular, unified, as tightly interconnected. For this notion of being internally stitched, biographically coherent beyond a mere succession of events, seems to lie at the heart of any claim we have to dignity as moral agents. It is, as Thomas Reed said, the foundation of all rights and obligations and of all accountableness. And a key notion is that of integrity, the sense that I am one, one enduring thing, that there is a unity across the different aspects of my life and behavior. This justifies our expectation that we will be respected. Other people will feel that they know what to expect of us. In return, we will feel entitled to expect that others too will be consistent, that they will have stable dispositions. And it's not enough that people should be programmed to replicate the same patterns of behavior. That same pattern has to have a coherent inside. Now, this idea of a coherent, enduring self has faced many challenges. And the most famous was lodged by David Hume in what must be one of the most quoted passages in philosophy. He sought his self through introspection, and this is what he found. For my part, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other of heat, cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I can never catch myself at any time without a perception and can never observe anything but the perception. He concluded that humans are nothing but a bundle of different perceptions which succeed each other with inconceivable rapidity and are in a perpetual flux and movement. The identity we ascribe to the mind of man, he said, is only a fictional one. Now, Hume's search for the self was informed by an assumption that predetermined its negative conclusion. For he assumed that the self should be a percept amongst percepts and that it could be grasped through turning his attention inwards. At the same time, unlike the fugitive impressions that cross our minds, it should endure over time, possibly over the entirety of our life, and hence be unlike any percept. Two irreconcilable demands. As Kant recognized, it is a mistake to think of the self as a percept, or even as a super-percept, not the least because the self is presupposed in perceptions, in the implicit sense that they are mine, that it is I who am perceiving them, that I am their subject. Kant suggested, in response to Hume, that there was an I-think which accompanies all my presentations or perceptions. Not a very satisfactory solution, and much puzzled over. A constant iteration of I-think seems implausibly donnish. What is more, the I of the I-think, which he specifically denied had a place in the empirical world of experiences, seemed to have no home at all. It was not easy to see how it engaged with, attached itself to, the actual experiences of actual beings. One consequence was that it was always at risk of being crash-dieted to a metaphysically skinny, size zero, purely logical subject. But at least Kant's intuitions seem to be in the right place. Now, some thinkers have rejected the challenge to find an enduring basis of personal identity that surmounts all the changes suffered by the experiencing self. Indeed, some have embraced the Humean vision out of suspicion that any notion of personal identity that denies Hume's findings will inevitably appeal to a Cartesian, Kantian, or quasi-theological transcendental ego. And this seems to have motivated many 20th century interpretations of the self, notably those of the existentialist philosophers, who, emphasizing the self's non-material nature and its role as a source of freedom, wanted to liberate it not only from thinghood, but from being any kind of substantive entity. The self, for Sartre, is nothingness, an imaginary construct. Philosophers such as Gilbert Ryle argue that the I was not only elusive, but systematically so. It could never become its own object any more than I could stand on my own shadow. In the second half of the last century, structuralist, post-structuralist, and post-modernist thinkers, mainly located in Paris, paradoxically the very capital of the ego, dissolved the self. It is a mere node in a system of signs. It is in the grip of various modes of the unconscious, political, socio-political, historical, psychoanalytical, linguistic, etc., through which it misrecognizes and is alienated from itself. Or it is a bourgeois or tropological construct, or in Jacques Lacan's Echo of Hume, a fiction. Some neuroscientists, apart from those who locate personal identity in bits of the brain, irritated they cannot find selves in neural activity, declare the I to be an illusion. Finally, there have been many neo-Humeans, influenced by Derek Parfit, whose position we shall discuss presently. Now, these views might have serious implications if we took them seriously. Notions of the self as an independent point of departure, the font of genuine action, the place where the buck starts, might be undermined. Luckily, we don't have to take them seriously. Indeed, we could have a lot of fun with them. We could ask Mr. Hume whether he thinks his repeated use of I in the passage we quoted is problematic. And we might ask the mighty egos that stalked the Parisian intellectual scene and attached so many publications and so much fame to their names whether this was all attached to nothing. But this is not today's business, and I shall take it that my audience accepts that there is something corresponding to the notion of the enduring self, that it is possible for the notion of personal identity to have non-reductive meaning without it having to be some kind of thing in itself, quasi-material object, or lifelong super-percept. So what is the basis of personal identity? Though the endurance of identity over time makes sense, as we said, only on the basis of identity at a given time, the former provides a helpful entree into the primary question of what personal identity is and why it matters. The philosophical question of endurance over time is expressed by Richard Swinburne as follows. What are the logically necessary and sufficient conditions for a person P2 at the time T2 being the same person as person P1 at the earlier time T1? Or loosely, what does it mean to say that P2 is the same person as P1? And there is another question linked with this. What evidence of observation and experience can we have that P2 is the same as P1? The search, therefore, is on for some basis of continuity over time in the face of change, something that is continuously and unchangeably present. Now, pre-modern philosophers would have invoked an enduring immaterial substance, perhaps the soul. Descartes partly modernized this as thinking substance. The truly modern engagement with the notion of personal identity over time, however, began with John Locke, who also chose an immaterial basis, though not a substance, but rather the connectedness of the psyche. For Locke, identity lay in our consciousness, and what was continuously present was not some individual mental item, such as a super-percept, but continuity over time, located in the internal connectedness of consciousness. This connectedness was secured most obviously through memory, the memory of our experiences. And Locke's account has powerful intuitive attractions. It's still influential. For example, it's echoed in Thomas Nagel's assertion in his 1986 philosophical masterpiece, The View from Nowhere, that I survive as long as I retain the capacity for conscious experience and my ability to re-identify myself by memory. Though Nagel's views are not precisely neo-Lockean. But continuity of memory seems to underpin so many other continuities. My enduring sense of what and where and who, the familiarity that makes the world my world and guides me through my life, my commitment to my commitments, my responsibility for delivering on my promises, and most directly, my sense of having temporal depth. Psychological continuity seems like the inner truth within the external facts of my constancy, reliability, and predictability, the private, essential take on the framework that gives stable sense to my life and enables me to make sense of myself and others to make sense of and to recognize me. But there are problems with Locke's theories. First, the extent of ourself is measured by the reach of memory, and memory doesn't seem to go back far enough. My memory gets patchier and patchier and more reprocessed and hence unreliable the further I go back. To describe my childhood, as Philip Larkin does, as a forgotten boredom, would be a little harsh on my parents, but I remember little of the 131,400 hours of the experiences of my first 15 years of life. And yet that child, RT, and me are the same person. We can mitigate the implications of this blankness a little by imagining a kind of relay, as Thomas Reed, who was opposed to Locke's theory, did. He gives the example of an aged general who does not remember the boy that he was told he once was, who got whipped for stealing apples. However, he can remember being a brave young subaltern and the subaltern recalls the lad who was whipped for stealing apples. This does not, however, really solve the problem, for we don't regain possession of our past through our memories. We can only infer that there is a chain of rememberers going right back, presumably to the infant, who may have some kind of recall of the previous day's nappy changes. This, however, contributes nothing to our sense of personal identity. We have a merely theoretical rather than living connection to our remote past, which is not in our own keeping. Derek Parfit, for whom personal identity dissolves without remainder into psychological continuity, tries to strengthen Locke. He advances the notion of overlapping chains of psychological contents, tying together successive phases of our psyche. These would include not only memories, but other psychological components. Memory, however, it seems to me, remains central to the intuitive attraction of Locke's theory. It is psychological connectedness made explicit. If memory is so important to enduring personal identity, it's reasonable to ask whether memories have to be in a state of being remembered to bind the person together. It's obvious that we're not at any given time engaged in remembering more than a minute fraction, even of those memories we have. If we had to keep a large number of our memories in play in order to count as being adequately connected with our past, so that ourselves at T1 could count as the same person as ourselves at T2, the price of having an enduring personal identity would be to live like Borges' monastic monster, Funes the Memorious, who could forget nothing. For the truth is, we live by leaving things behind, and we need amnesia if an over-replete present consciousness is not going to become a kind of delirium of reminiscence. Most importantly, the Lockean account, which has a rather vague view on what counts as sufficient psychological connectedness to constitute continuity of self, seems to be at odds with our intuition that personal identity, to use Reed's phrase, has no ambiguity and admits of no degrees of more or less. To translate this, I does not pass through a penumbra of I-ish as it fades to not I. As the line of connectedness becomes less dense, the sense of I does not attenuate. For Parfit, who does not believe that personal identity is determinate, is yes or no, and that what matters is not the continuation of something called personal identity, but the future of a human series of experiences that we have, this is not a problem. For me, who does not believe that rementalis dissolves into a succession of experiences, it is a problem. Either rementalis is, or rementalis is not. At least that's what rementalis thinks. He doesn't think he can be a teeny-weeny bit rementalis any more than anyone can be a teeny-weeny bit pregnant. There is a further problem with seeking continuing personal identity and psychological connectedness through memory. How can I be sure that a memory I'm having now is a true memory of an actual experience, of an experience that I had? Vividness of recall is no sure guide to authenticity of apparent memories. The great psychologist Jean Piaget reported that his earliest memory was a very precise and terrifying image. He had a clear memory of being in the Jardin de Luxembourg with his nurse when she was attacked by a man wanting to steal him from his pram. It was only many years later that his nurse confessed that she had fabricated the entire incident to earn herself praise. This question of validation, what makes these memories authentic memories of experiences that I have had, connects with the profound insight expressed by Bishop Butler when he challenged Locke's rooting of personal identity in sameness of consciousness. This, he said, was a wonderful mistake, for it is self-evident that consciousness of personal identity presupposes and therefore cannot constitute personal identity. In other words, personal identity is not an objective given, which we then discover, say, on the basis of memories that we feel confident are ours. Butler seems sound here. To found one's sense of identity on anything else, even memories that are felt to be valid because one had the experiences corresponding to them, and one has the evidence that there is the right kind of causal relationship between the memories and the experiences that the memories are of, is to put the cart before the horse. Just as quizzing me on little-known facts about the life of Raymond Tallis seems a good way for others to check my claim to be Raymond Tallis, a high score on such a quiz could not underpin or even strengthen my sense of being myself. Imagining that it could is connected with a failure to recognize that personal identity goes deeper or is presupposed in identification and re-identification. The feeling that these memories are mine and are authentic because they are of experiences that are mine, that I have had, must itself be rooted in a pre-existing sense of personal identity, of that I am this, a this that is currently having these memories and previously had the experiences preserved in the memories. It certainly seems odd to think of personal identity as something you arrive at as a kind of conclusion. We're led down this peculiar path, as Butler pointed out, because we're using the term identity loosely, as we do when we apply it to objects such as trees, ships, and gentlemen's clubs, when we do indeed have to invoke external criteria for justifying the use of the term and for arriving at what is essentially identification. The iteration that I am is a presupposition that precedes any investigation of what I am. Psychological connectedness does not, therefore, deliver the sense of personal identity. It is presupposed in it. Well, let me now examine another basis that's been offered for the sameness of identity over time, and which has also been offered as a basis for my identity at any given time, namely my body. I am my body, it is argued, and my enduring self is rooted in my relatively stable body. Certainly, the body, I and I only, have had all my life seems a plausible repository for my personal identity, at least when we focus on its continuity over time. This needs clarification, however. I am obviously not just the physical material of my body, which outlasts me, even though it does not outlive me. Otherwise, I might have to allow that my corpse, which for a while at any rate, is not materially much different from my body at the time of death, and certainly less different from my body immediately prior to my death than it is from my body as a child, would seem a continuation of my personal identity. Erik Olsen argued in The Human Animal that identity resides not in the material of the body, but in the biological processes in the living organism that is Homo sapiens. And he's led to the conclusion that even people in a permanent coma or a persistent vegetative state still retain their identity. He enthusiastically welcomes these, to me, unwelcome consequences of his position, because he wants to separate personal identity from consciousness. Indeed, the subtitle of his book, a very good book, is Personal Identity Without Psychology. Persons are human animals, and no sort of psychological continuity is either necessary or sufficient for a human animal to persist through time. Admittedly, Olsen's identification of personal identity with the living animal body does dispose of some difficulties. It deals with our undeniable but seemingly puzzling connection with an object in the remote past that doesn't have personal identity. For example, the fetus we once were. How can I be linked to an eyeless fetus or neonate? The answer is straightforward if I believe that my identity resides in my animal body. I am this animal body, which happens to have an egoless phase preceding a phase with an ego. And locating personal identity in the body is helpful in another regard. By means of the body, our memories and other psychological contents are situated in a nexus of objective fact and checkable reality. Experiences and the memories that make them part of my enduring identity over time are tethered to real places and real times. My body, the public face of my identity, also connects identity with identification. That reinforcement of my sense of self that comes from others whose lives intersect or intertwine with mine. It links the private space of recollection with the public realm, with micro and macro society, the subjective sense of being me with the objective data record and ID cards. That, of course, wouldn't fit with Olsen's conception of the body, minus its psychological contents. While by locating personal identity in the human organism, Olsen gets round a few difficulties, he does seem to bypass the very essence of what lies at the heart of personal identity, the sense, the intuition, the feeling, the quasi-assertion that I am what I am. It gives a plausible marker of continuity of the self over time, but it doesn't seem to offer continuity of the self as such. As Locke says, person stands for a thinking, intelligent being that can consider itself as itself. Most damningly, without this subjective dimension, it is difficult to see how identity could arise in the body, for the reasons I gave at the outset of my talk. A personless body does not have the status of being a single coherent thing. It can be taken as one body, many organs, millions of cells, trillions of atoms, and so on. Unity does not come free. We must therefore draw two conclusions. Firstly, personal identity cannot be a matter of the psyche solely. Standalone memories cannot provide the basis either for the moment-to-moment sense of self, nor for the confidence we have in being the same person over time, that we are temporally extended. These psychological contents are rootless or untethered. So we need the body as well, But secondly, a standalone body cannot provide personal identity. That's for sure. It is personless. So we need both psyche and soma, with the psychological continuity, perhaps, providing the inner aspect of the enduring self, and the corporeal continuity, that outer aspect. But not one merely added to the other. And I want now to suggest a way of construing personal identity that combines both body and mind, psyche and soma, without the two being merely conjoined. Such an account of the self will take its rise not from continuity of identity over time, but with identity at any given time. If I envisage personal identity as something that begins with the awakening of the human body to itself, the intuition that it is and that it is itself, that's how I envisage it. That is what I have called the existential intuition. And this, it seems to me, is the sine qua non, the beating heart of personal identity. The existential intuition cannot readily be described. It is immediately experienced. But it could be cast in the form that I am this, where this, in the first instance, is one's own body. Now, this looks like an assertion or a proposition. That's how I've had to present it. But to think of it being in itself either as an assertion or a proposition would be to replicate in part the error of Kant's notion of the I think that accompanies all my perceptions. Even the word intuition is too narrow, suggesting as it does an inchoate thought. We may think of the sense that one is this thing, that one is the thing one is, initially as a slowly spreading blush, engaging more and more of the body, with key landmarks such as the discovery of one's hands and later one's toes. The human body, we might say, is itself by virtue of the fact that it ams itself. At the point of origin of personal identity, in a newborn, wakening to itself, psyche and soma are one. The inchoate I identifies with the sentient body. We may envisage a gradual awakening to the body as one's own, as oneself, and through the body to the world, so that bodily self-awareness becomes the elaborate correlative of a personal world. This is the context in which the I emerges in the body and personal identity is established in and of a body that will precede and outlast it. Without the existential intuition, which lies at the heart of first person being, without this sense that I am this at any particular time, there is no basis for the sense that I am the same thing over time. The intuition that I am this must precede any question as to whether I am or am not the same this. And this is really the point of what Thomas Reed said. Without, as it were, self-appropriation, self-stipulation, the question cannot arise as to whether or not something is the same thing over time. Or it can be resolved only by an external fiat that says that the acorn is or is not the same as the oak tree, the club is or is not the same club as the one that went under the same name but had different premises, rules, and membership 100 years ago. In invoking the existential intuition, I have not provided a fully worked out theory of personal identity. Indeed, you might feel that had you blinked, you would have missed my positive doctrine. Most notably, I have not emphasized, even less attempted to give an account of the sense of temporal depth that informs the moment-to-by-moment self, which draws on a past and reaches into a future. Rather, I've indicated a new point of departure for the philosophical investigation of this topic, which may redirect inquiry into what I believe may be more interesting areas, and I want to spend the remainder of my talk pointing to some of these. This inquiry will not mobilize those endlessly recycled and picked over and irritating thought experiments, brain transplants, duplicates, transputers, and so on, that have so bedeviled the field and so fascinated the film industry. I find them unhelpful because it is difficult to judge their validity, as one does not know whether it is logical or empirical possibilities that are being discussed. And contrary to what is usually assumed, such experiments are interesting only if they describe empirical possibilities. And I happen not to believe that a standalone brain, or part of brain, could house personhood, identity, or even memories. The existential intuition could not arise and be sustained in a standalone brain, as it would have no referent for this. Such thought experiments therefore describe scenarios that cannot arise in fact, even if they are logically possible. The brain, by the way, is unconscious of itself. One line of investigation might take its rise from the peculiar location of the existential intuition, that I am this, on the borderland between a tautology, I am I, and an empirical assertion, such as I am Raymond Tallis. This anomalous logical status of first person being was first sensed by Descartes, of course, for whom it became a subsequently much contested point of intersection between logic and existence, in the famous cogito argument, where he proved his own existence or reminded us that it could not be doubted. I think, therefore I am. This actually is not so much an argument. Indeed, there's actually less in its conclusions than is provided in its premises, as a rather thin, brief rehearsal of the existential intuition, a paler blush of I am. At any rate, first-person being, awakening of parts of the material world to their own existence, a blush of self-realization, looks like a tautology that has empirical content. Of course, that content is available in the first instance only to the I that has the intuition. Does this mean that I am the supreme authority on what I am? There is an interesting problem of determining in a principal way the boundary between the sense of I and of what I am that is not open to challenge, a quasi-tautology, and that part of what I feel myself to be which is open to correction. I cannot be mistaken that I am I. I might be mistaken that I am Raymond Tellis when Raymond Tellis designates a set of biographical details. And I definitely could be mistaken in thinking that I was born in England or am 5'10" tall. At first, it seems that it should be easy to specify what characterizes those things about myself which I can be mistaken over and those over which I cannot be mistaken. But it's not. There has been a lively philosophical debate, or fairly lively anyway, about the scope of self-knowledge, about whether we even know our own thoughts, or whether, given that the meaning of the words in which they are expressed is externally determined, we can even know what it is that we are currently thinking. Paul Varley's delicious observation that we are made of many things that know nothing of us, which is why we do not know ourselves, captures an unease we have about the supposed cognitive transparency of this I that is asserted quasi-tautologically in the existential intuition. If uncorrectable self-stipulation that I am this, which admits of no degrees, as Reed said, is the core of personal identity, what is the scope of the this? Descartes' systematic doubt placed even the body outside the charmed circle within which the existential intuition was an unchallengeable tautology. All I could be sure of was of myself as a currently thinking substance, perhaps not even a substance. Strawson and many others subsequently, including your recently appointed Knightbridge Professor of Philosophy, Kasim Kassam, have argued, I believe persuasively, that self-consciousness must refer itself to, have as its internal accusative, an object in the weighty sense. That is to say, an item that is capable not only of being perceived, but also of existing unperceived. Echoing Thomas Reed's observation that identity presupposes an uninterrupted continuity of existence, which perceptions and the like cannot boast. Now, there seems to be only one candidate for this post of object in the weighty sense, my body. And this is central to the notion of personal identity, as you have seen, as I developed here. But what do we mean by the body in this context? This is not an empty question. For there's quite a lot of my body that has little to do with myself or my sense of self. My spleen and I are scarcely on speaking terms. Bone marrow and toenails do not acknowledge me. And they seem clearly outside the scope of the existential intuition. For the least we should expect of any part of the body that is gathered up in the this that I intuitively am, that I assume as myself, is that I should be aware of it without mediation. We incompletely colonize our own bodies. And even in the case of the more accessible parts of the body, it's possible to make very large mistakes as to whether parts of one's body are one's own, as in the case of stroke patients with the alien hand syndrome, who disown part of the body and even the actions in which they're engaged. What is more, the phenomenal body, as the French philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty called it, that part which is explicitly engaged in my actions and feels like me, will vary from moment to moment, depending upon what I'm engaged in. When I'm lost in deep thought, nearly all my body drops off the radar screen, which is perhaps why many philosophers, for whom deep thought is an occupational hazard, have been inclined to identify the self with the mind, and even as in Descartes' case, the deeply thinking mind. Furthermore, we have different and fluctuating relations even to those parts of our body that touch on our self-awareness and seem eligible for inclusion in the scope of the existential intuition. We variously own, utilize, suffer, enjoy, take care of, and know portions of our body. And none of these relations quite amounts to gapless identity. Indeed, as we introspect our experiences of our body, candidates for being what we are seem to retreat to the far end of our inner gaze, another manifestation of Gilbert Ryle's systematic elusiveness of the I. And this is to be expected, because am is an assumption, not an inference. We assume and are assumed by the fleshly basis of our identity, rather than discovering or identifying it. As a relation, of course, true identity is so close, perhaps, not to count as a relation at all, or to be a relation that holds up only so long as it doesn't break up into separate relata, which is exactly what you would expect. In strict identity, there's only one relatum. It is the relationship, it is the entity that has the relationship to itself. Now, at any rate, it's difficult to specify the scope of the existential intuition and its immunity from challenge, to define its domain as a quasi-tautology. Well, we've drilled to the heart of personal identity, but how does personal identity grow beyond its heart? Our sense of identity, after all, extends beyond the body, and the question then arises as to how the existential intuition anchored in the body unfolds into a self that is the complement of a world. How does this awakening to our bodies awaken out of our bodies to an objective shared reality that is sustained by a community of human minds? How does the I crystallize out of the self-aware body and evolve to a social self? How does a robust, accountable ego arise out of the sensory delirium of infancy? And asking these questions asks us to consider even more fundamental questions. What is the relationship between the continuous now of the self and the temporally extended person, explicitly rooted in the past and reaching into an explicit future? What is the relationship between the instantaneous, iterated existential intuition, the inner time sense of the self, and the objective temporal order of the shared world, which, amongst other things, upholds our narrative sense of identity? When we think about the interface between our subjective self and the objective world, we enter an area of great existential concern. When I cross the boundary between that of which I cannot possibly be mistaken to that over which I might be in error or deceived, we enter the realm of the facts of my case. There's something disturbing about being attached to such facts. We find it difficult to be or to coincide with them in order that the immediate apprehension of what I am should color in the objective facts about me. There is a drift towards the impersonal, from I am to it is. The assertion I am 5'10" can be glossed as Raymond Tallis's 5'10" or it is 5'10". And this is connected with the vexed question of the relationship between the singular who and the general what in personal identity. When, as adolescents, we ask, what am I? We long for an answer that makes us seem singular and thus irreplaceable. And yet at the same time, we want to identify with something larger than ourselves, a cult, a cause, a fashion, a nation. We come to our who via a lattice of whats that are not unique to ourselves. The existential intuition is reinforced by seeing itself in a mirror of generalities. The tendency for the search for a singular who to drift into an inventory of general whats is a consequence, ultimately, of the fact that in making ourselves intelligible to ourselves, indeed in making ourselves visible to ourselves, we need to place ourselves under the aspect of generality. The sense of being a substitutable anyone is mitigated by our somewhat vulnerable belief that the combination of generalities is unique and the unquestionable truth that they are applied to a body that has a unique trajectory through space-time. But the very things that seem to nail us to a general identity seem also to elude us. This is not just a question of role distance, as in the case of Sartre's famous waiter, who is trying to be a waiter just as an inkwell is an inkwell, but ends up only playing at being a waiter, but of the relationship between the bodily awareness in which the existential intuition arises and in which it remains anchored, and the facts we live by and take account of and accept when they're imputed to us. The pervasive sense that we fail fully to be the facts of our case, those facts in which we see an image of ourselves, those generalities through which we become intelligible ourselves, is experienced as a kind of hollowness. And this is perhaps the defining character, or if one was inclined to take it tragically, the defining tragedy of human consciousness, of our being self-conscious, knowing animals. Our who constructs itself as a what that cannot entirely or stably be. Nevertheless, this failure of coincidence may be the basis of our freedom. We are liberated from our bodies by the generalities of cultural facts, and from our culture by the unique trajectories of our embodied selves. I offer this suggestion somewhat tentatively. One master theme informing these observations is that of the relationship between the subjective and objective aspects of identity, between the unassailable sense that I am, which must have some content, and what I am, which also has content, but not the same. The latter grows out of the former, but there are tensions between them. This becomes especially notable in the slippage or disconnect between my subjective, unchanging sense of I and the objectively changing person others see me to be. I am I, whatever objective I am. The iteration, the core sense of being myself, feels the same irrespective of whether that which is iterated changes. We feel we are this person, even if others think we are no longer this person. We're often the last to notice changes in ourselves, and most poignantly, people with dementia seem to have a relatively strong existential intuition and I-based wishes to a very late stage when the connected world of their fully mature adult self has been pretty well dismantled. These, then, are potentially interesting fields of inquiry opened up by an approach to personal identity that insists on the priority of the subjective over the objective and of identity at a given time over enduring identity over time, secured by placing the existential intuition at the heart of personal identity. So let me end by reminding you of the key claims I put forward in this talk. Firstly, along with Bishop Butler and Thomas Reed, I've argued that there is no real identity outside of our personal identity. Second, identity itself is not to be reduced to the objective basis of or the criteria for its own continuity over time, however important the latter is. Thirdly, personal identity is not to be found either in the mind alone or the body alone. It is in the human body's awakening to itself, as itself, in the existential intuition that I'm this. Finally, while this account of personal identity avoids some problems associated with the purely psychological or purely corporeal accounts of personhood, it leaves much unfinished business. Indeed, it highlights many new problems, or it casts the existing problems in a novel, and I would like to think, more interesting light. Thank you.